Can anyone imagine Mouse talking to Nixon like that? Ambrose asks. And then answering his own question, he says, in fact, yes, here as elsewhere, Stone counts on his audience believing that it is possible that Dick and Jack were friends, that the Nixon marriage was always on the verge of breaking apart, and that Mao would say such things to Nixon, Ambrose wrote. But here's the real point about Oliver Stone, and Ambrose sums it up as well as anyone. Stone thinks that the United States is rotten because of the sinister forces that rule. He used both Kennedy and Nixon to prove it. He wants to change the country and points to the Kennedy assassination and the Nixon presidency as proof of the need for radical political action. In that sense, Ambrose writes, it matters greatly that he has distorted the past. 64. James Walcott. James Walcott is a respected columnist for the ultra-chic Vanity Fair magazine. On Election Day 2004, he posted the following message on his website. I am preparing myself for either outcome today. Should Kerry win, I will post an important statement called A Time for Healing, or something equally noble-sounding. Should Bush win, I shall post a statement of philosophical resignation, tentatively titled, Good, go ahead, America, choke on your own vomit, you deserve to die. The latter will probably require a little more tweaking. This is what is known as sophisticated wit in such sophisticated witty places as Manhattan. Except you just know he's not kidding, not even a little. So there is simply no other way to say this. America will never come back together, liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, blue states, red states, as long as journalists like James Walcott hold important positions at big mainstream media outlets. Intelligent and urbane as Walcott may be, his entire take on this country and its people requires a lot of tweaking. 63. Amy Richards. Here's a little quiz. Assume you're a feminist who is pregnant with triplets. What does hell look like? Give up? Answer, Costco, on Staten Island. The mayonnaise aisle, to be precise. This is pretty much how Amy Richards sees it. If her guest column in the July 18, 2004, Sunday New York Times magazine is any indication. And it's also pretty much the least of her problems. Rarely have I read anything so chilling as Miss Richards' essay titled When One Is Enough, on the subject of what is euphemistically called selective reduction. Who is Amy Richards? Well, to judge from the piece, she's simply an average citizen sharing her firsthand experiences with abortion. Only later, prompted by revelations on the internet, does the New York Times bother informing its readers that Amy Richards is in fact a longtime abortion rights activist, a little piece of information that might have, as the Times puts it, shed some light on her mindset. In her essay, Miss Richards tells us that she is 34 years old, lives in Manhattan, went off the pill because it made her moody, and became pregnant. Her boyfriend, Peter, whom she's been with for 3 years, is the father. At the doctor's office, she gets the unexpected news that she's carrying 3 fetuses. My immediate response was, I cannot have triplets, Miss Richards tells us. I was not married. I lived in a 5-story walk-up in the East Village. I worked freelance, and I would have had to go on bed rest in March. I lecture at colleges, and my biggest months are March and April. I would have had to give up my main income for the rest of the year. There was a part of me that was sure I could work around that, but it was a matter of, do I want to? What do you think? I looked at Peter and asked the doctor, is it possible to get rid of one of them, or two of them? The obstetrician wasn't an expert in selective reduction, but she knew that with a shot of potassium chloride, you could eliminate one or more. Which is just what Miss Richards decides to do. Get rid of one or two of them. After all, she writes, if she kept all 3, this is where the mayo at Costco on Staten Island comes in. I'd have to give up my life, I'm going to have to move to Staten Island. I'll never leave my house because I'll have to care for these children. I'll have to start shopping only at Costco and buying big jars of mayonnaise. The point is not that Amy Richards is in favor of abortion, an issue as complicated and contentious as any in our public life. The point is that this woman is the poster child for all those who so easily reduce the procedure simply to a matter of personal convenience. Amy Richards is not even embarrassed to let the world know she would rather croak than leave her five-story walk-up in Manhattan for a place like Staten Island, that she'd rather greenlight a couple of shots of chloride to the hearts of the twins than give up her biggest income months on the college lecture circuit. When we saw the specialist, Richard goes on, we found that I was carrying identical twins and a standalone. My doctors thought the standalone was 3 days older. There was something psychologically comforting about that, since I wanted to have just one. Psychologically comforting? Well, yes, because armed with this new information, the choice was easy. The twins go, the standalone stays, a shot of potassium chloride to the heart of the fetus takes care of the whole thing, she writes without a hint of emotion. So, how does the Amy Richards saga end? She tells us that she had a boy and everything is fine. Really? I think the jury is still out on that one. Who knows what her son will think when he grows up and finds out about the siblings that his mom got rid of, the ones who were so efficiently eliminated. Who knows what he will think if he ever reads her frightening essay in the New York Times. If he has a shred of humanity that his mother so proudly lacks, he'll be sick. 62. Howard Stern. I have friends whom I admire and whose opinions I respect who tell me they like Howard Stern. They tell me they like his honesty, how he's not afraid to go against the grain and take the un-PC position. They liked it, for example, when he said the cops in Los Angeles who beat Rodney King didn't beat this idiot enough. No, my friends are not bigots. They just like the fact that Stern was saying what a lot of people with common sense wanted to say about a moron high on PCP who led the cops on a late-night high-speed chase all over town but didn't have the guts to say themselves. But come on, who are we kidding? The honesty most of his fans really like is the same honesty that kids have, the uncontrollable compulsion to say whatever comes into their undeveloped little minds, like, boy, you make stinky farts. For instance, they like the way Howard makes fun of retarded people. Once, when he took his radio show to Las Vegas in front of a live audience, Stern hosted a segment he called Retarded Card Sharks and asked contestants questions like, what does T-O-O-T-H spell? Answer, 7. Everybody howled at how stupid the retarded guy was. They like the way he exploits people with cleft palates, people who stutter, and people like Vomit Man, whose claim to fame is that he stinks to get cheap laughs. But mostly, of course, they like the sex, the nonstop, never-ending sex. On one show, Stern told a female guest, I need you to nude model for me and my penis. I'm swollen bigger than Rosie O'Donnell's head. Once he asked a bikini-clad model to play a game with him. If you get a question wrong, you have to have sex with me. We make out, I touch your cans, and you grab my ass. As a consolation prize to a grandfather and a grandson who lost out in a dating game contest, Stern fixed them up with a prostitute who had offered to sleep with both of them. And then there's the lesbian sex, the endless parade of women who strip so Howard can evaluate their asses, and all sorts of other assorted losers who routinely come on to do almost anything, just so they can bask in the glow of their sun god, Howard Stern. None of this means that I think Howard Stern should be taken off the air for indecency. That's not what this is about at all. This is a very big, very free country, and people should be allowed to say almost anything, even on the radio, even, I'm afraid, in the morning. No, this is about something else entirely. It's about Howard Stern as a form of pollution, as a kind of sludge that runs through our culture today. Once upon a time in America, it would have been impossible for someone like Howard Stern to become a star on radio, TV, or even in a flea circus. Not long ago, if a radio personality got caught thinking, "You're making me hard, come over here and sit on my lap," he'd be finished. Today, in our more open, more honest America, he becomes the king of all media. Leave Howard Stern on the air. Let him have his soon-to-be satellite radio show, but please, don't turn him into a First Amendment poster boy. Howard is what he is, a smart man with some interesting thoughts on some important issues, who plays a 50-something-year-old junior high school kid who loves to see how far he can push it, how much he can shock us. And this, in the end, is Howard Stern's most significant, lasting, and saddest legacy. That the king of all shock jocks no longer shocks us, not even a little. We become used to all of it. The fart jokes, the humiliation of easy targets, the all-sex-all-the-time humor. It simply washes over us, like sludge in a polluted river, just part of our daily environment. 61. Michael Savage. Let's say you call in to Michael Savage's immensely popular, nationally syndicated radio talk show. And let's say he doesn't like what you just told him about gays or abortion or immigration or anything else. There's a good chance the next words you're going to hear, aimed right at you, you pathetic loser, will be something like, "You are a commie pinko pervert." And that's only if he's feeling generous that day. It's not for nothing that Michael Savage has been called America's angriest, most vicious conservative radio host. At a time when we can use a lot more civility in our national discourse, you can count on Michael Savage to tell you to take your pansy-ass civility and drop dead, you little hateful nothings, you stinking rat hiding in the sewers. A few years back, in the summer of 2003, Savage had a weekend talk show on MSNBC when someone called in with something he didn't like. "So you're one of those sodomites. Are you a sodomite?" Savage demanded. The caller replied, "Yes, I am." "Oh, you're one of those sodomites. You should only get AIDS and die, you pig. How's that?" "How's that? MSNBC fired him. That's how that is." Savage's brand of over-the-top bile, which puts him right in there with the angriest haters on the left, plays right into the hands of liberals who use him as a bludgeon against even mainstream conservatives. To them, Michael Savage is not simply someone who gives voice to the right wing's darkest fantasies, as one profile put it, but that he's typical of all conservatives. As his listeners know, Savage has a catchphrase that he usually shouts at full volume when he confronts someone or something he finds monumentally stupid. "I can't take this anymore." Small world. A lot of us can't take this anymore either. 60. Ludicrous. If a bunch of white racists got together and tried to come up with a way to make young black guys look really dumb, like demented caricatures of real black men, first they'd invent gangster rap, and then they'd invent somebody just like Ludacris. Ludacris, in case you're not familiar with the name, is a giant in the dingy world of gangster rap. His songs are about the usual stuff. Bitches, hoes, niggas, and, well, that pretty much sums it up. He's very big with kids, too many of whom get their values from the pop culture and the street guys like Ludacris, instead of from a mother and father at home. But to really understand this artistic giant, it's best that you experience Ludacris in his own words. So here is a sampler from a number of his hits, including several from his big CD, Word of Mouth. "The game got switched on some Ludacris shit, so you all can suck my dick, bitch. I make niggas eat dirt and fart dust, then give you an $80 gift certificate to Pussies R Us." Is Ludacris the worst of the bunch? Of course not. They're all the worst. When it comes to gangster rap and the glorification of ignorance, it's one big giant tie for last place. Still, given his popularity and all the support he enjoys from the hoes and different area codes, Ludacris certainly merits recognition on the list. 59. Shirley Franklin. As bad as some of the gangster rappers are, the ones who try to give them an aura of respectability are worse. Take Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin. On June 7, 2004, Mayor Franklin and the Atlanta City Council honored Chris Bridges, Ludacris's real name, with an official proclamation citing his good works, giving money to some poor people in Atlanta. Mayor Franklin's justification for honoring the rapper, while there may be those who dislike or have personal differences with Ludacris, his contributions to young people through the work of his foundation, blah, 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 rightly infuriated decent people who saw right through it. As Juan Williams, the Fox News and NPR commentator, put it on the O'Reilly Factor, it's outrageous. To me, what you've got here is a situation where the mayor, Shirley Franklin, says, hey, look, you know what? There is some good that this man does with his charities. But how ridiculous. Would you say that about a drug dealer? Would you say that about someone who is a gangster, who is killing people? No. That Juan Williams is black and liberal is not beside the point. Like Bill Cosby, he has had enough. And like Bill Cosby, he's not afraid to say what a lot of the black establishment won't say. So a lot of these people are trying to put a nice face on what is a very ugly situation, Williams added, which is basically, they say to young black people, if you want to be authentically black, you have to dress like you just got out of prison, got your pants hanging off your butt and your hat turned around and calling people horrible names, the kind of abuse of women that I just think has no place in the black community, especially in a community where we see so much family breakup. Hey, lighten up, Juan. You can't expect the mayor of a big city like Atlanta, Georgia, to care about high-minded stuff like that, not when some guy is handing out free money to poor people in town. That is, when he's not rapping about niggas who eat dirt and fart dust. Come on, Juan. That would be ludicrous. 58. Eminem. Go to Google and punch in Eminem, the white rap artist who gives depravity a bad name. You get over 13 million hits. That's more than for Queen Elizabeth, Winston Churchill, Albert Einstein, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Jonas Salk, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, Christopher Columbus, Abraham Lincoln, or even Princess Diana. There are more hits for Jesus Christ than Eminem, but not much more. Which is another way of saying that Eminem cannot be ignored, no matter how hard we may try. It's not that he's more vulgar than a million other gangster rappers. It's that, at least in part because he's white, he appeals to so many more kids than other rappers. He not only sells millions and millions of CDs, he also starred in a hit movie about his own life. Eminem is such a cultural icon, in fact, that it's not just teenagers who think he's hot. Apparently, so does a certain type of well-educated, sophisticated, middle-aged woman. Like, for instance, New York Times resident girlish adolescent Maureen Dowd. A gaggle of my girlfriends are surreptitiously smitten with Eminem, Maureen Dowd wrote in her New York Times column. They buy his posters on eBay. They play him on their Walkman at the gym. Yes, of course, these are sad women trying to hang on to their youth at the expense of their dignity. Yet, what is troubling is that they and others in the progressive elite community have lent Eminem respectability, even cachet, and that gives him all the more power to spread his destructive messages. As Bob Herbert, another New York Times columnist, has put it, Eminem is a white rapper who has burrowed his way to the nauseating depths of degradation and self-loathing pioneered by gangster-rapping blacks. No image is too vile. In Eminem's world, all women are whores, and he is eager to rape and murder them. He dares us to question whether he would choke a woman till the vocal cords don't work in her throat no more. Or how about this lovely line from a song appropriately called No One's Iller Than Me? Ripped this old lady, hung her neck by a hook, didn't realize it was my grandmother till I checked her pocketbook. As Bob Herbert writes, this stuff is readily available to 10-year-olds, which should make any serious person both angry and sad. A steady diet of this ugliness is poisonous, the equivalent of developing one's self-image by looking in a toilet. Frankly, I don't give a damn about whether Maureen Dowd's ditzy girlfriends are smitten or not with Eminem, but we should all be worried about all those kids staring into the toilet. 57. Ted Field. Ted Field is rich. Sure, it's possible that Bill Gates or some Saudi sheikh might not think he's loaded, but Ted's doing okay, if you consider having a net worth of about $1.2 billion is doing okay. Field, who was born Frederick Woodruff Field on June 1, 1953, got his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it from his family. The Fields owned Chicago's legendary Marshall Field department store. So when he was old enough to take the silver spoon out of his mouth, young Ted could have done just about anything he wanted with his money. He could have stayed in Chicago and got into the family business. Or he could have spent his life windsurfing off of some island he could easily have bought for himself. But Ted Field wanted to do something important. Like so many other guys born rich, FDR and JFK come to mind, he wanted to have an impact on American life, which he indeed has had, and which is precisely why he's on this list. Here's what Field did with his money. The young man went west, all the way to Hollywood, where he donned leather jackets and sunglasses and contributed to American culture by producing movies and raising cash for Democrats. He was good at the latter, but regarding the former, an executive at Disney once told Vanity Fair, "Ted Field knows no more about day-to-day producing than you do." In any case, Ted Field's real claim to fame has nothing to do with the movies or with politics either. His lasting contribution to the culture is that he's the white guy who took his fortune and started up a record company called Interscope, an act that made Ted Field a true American pioneer, the man who helped make mostly black gangster rap the malignant force it has become in American life. Nice going, my Caucasian. Field may not have been the brains behind the operation. That would be his partner Jimmy Iovine, an otherwise accomplished producer executive. But without Ted Field's deep pockets, there would have been no Interscope, the company that gave the world, among others, Eminem, Snoop Dogg, and through the infamous Death Row, which joined the Interscope family in 1992, Tupac Shakur. For this alone, Ted Field should be enshrined in cement on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, not just his hands. All of him. Someone who would be glad to do the honors is a smart, passionate, anti-gangster rap activist named C. Dolores Tucker, who heads an organization called the Political Council of Black Women. Ms. Tucker is on a crusade, convinced that gangster rap is one of the forces undermining black kids in America today. She once testified before a congressional committee that gangster music is drug-driven, race-driven, sex-driven, greed-driven, and violence-driven. And she condemned Ted Field by name as one of the wealthy mavens of the record industry who produce gangster rap filth. But Ted Field couldn't care less. His contempt for Dolores Tucker and anyone else who cares about the endless stream of violence and depravity he has brought to American kids was perfectly captured in this charming and gracious observation. "You can tell the people who want to stop us from releasing controversial rap music one thing," Field said. "Kiss my ass." 56. Diane Sawyer. There have been many dumb celebrity interviews on news magazine programs, many interviews that have nothing to do with real news, that no self-respecting journalist would ever do. But the exclusive interview that Diane Sawyer did with Britney Spears for Primetime Thursday on November 13, 2003, for me anyway, was the day the music died. Here's a brief exchange between the two divas. "You can bop me. I have to ask a couple of things about Justin," Diane tells Britney, referring to the singer's old boyfriend, Justin Timberlake. "He's gone on television and pretty much said you broke his heart. You did something that caused him so much pain, so much suffering," Miss Sawyer says in that same serious tone she uses when interviewing someone like Henry Kissinger. "What did you do?" Canny and discreet as ever, Britney tries to evade the question, saying only, "He'll always have a special place in my heart." But this isn't good enough for the tough veteran reporter who demands facts, not spin. But you said, I've only slept with one person in my whole life, 2 years into my relationship with Justin, and yet he's left the impression that you were unfaithful, that you betrayed the relationship. I'm not technically saying he's wrong, Britt tells Di, but I'm not technically saying he's right either. But Diane's relentless search for the truth is only getting started. What about the kiss, the one between Britney and Madonna on a live broadcast of MTV's Video Music Awards show? Diane skeptically observes, you said there's no tongue action here. Oh, of course there was no tongue. Gosh, no, Britney insists. Diane isn't buying any of it. Well, it looked like it. It looked like there was, she says, before moving on to even more serious subjects, like Britney's ass. And you don't like the famous bottom, the world-famous? The always curious Diane Sawyer wants to know. The world-famous bottom? Ooh, don't say that, Britney tells Diane. And then comes the payoff, this wonderfully enlightening exchange about a song on Britney's new CD, specifically a tune about masturbation. I mean, it's not something you openly talk about with a lot of people. It's something sacred, B tells D. This leaves Diane, who used to cover the State Department for CBS News and who could have put her foot down and refused to do the Britney interview in the first place had she wanted to, stunned. Sacred, she says. This comeback from Diane flusters young Britney, who still manages to get out, it is sacred, but in a way, okay, I'm confusing myself right now. No, it's not exactly Eric Severide interviewing Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Still, Britney has no need to apologize for confusing herself. I'm confused, too. I thought Diane Sawyer was a journalist. 55. David Weston. Ted Koppel is worried. He's worried that television news isn't as serious as it ought to be. He thinks that's the fault of people in the TV news business who believe they can get more viewers if they dumb down the news, and he thinks it's a losing strategy. Speaking to broadcasters in Los Angeles on April 20, 2004, the ABC News anchorman said, "When we began taking our journalism more lightly, people began taking us less seriously. I have no problem whatsoever with entertainers and comedians pretending to be journalists," Koppel said. "My problem is with journalists pretending to be entertainers." Good for you, Ted. Thanks for saying what needed to be said. There's just one problem. Ted Koppel, like most of the media elite, is part of the club. And in the club, you never push it too far. You never, for example, name names and say exactly who is causing all these problems you care so much about. That would be a violation of club rules and considered rude. But I'm sure Ted could have come up with a few names if he really wanted. In fact, he could have started with his own boss, David Weston, the president of ABC News. At ABC News, the buck stops at David Weston's desk. He can say no to infotainment. He can decree that when an ABC News correspondent questions Britney Spears about masturbation, it gives the viewers reason to take us at ABC News less seriously, and he could refuse to put it on the air. But he doesn't do that. Once television news presidents were men of great courage and great integrity. Once there was a healthy tension between the presidents of network news divisions who cared passionately about the integrity of news and the corporate guys who cared passionately about the integrity of the bottom line. After Ted Koppel finished his prepared remarks, a student in the audience asked him what young journalists should do if they find themselves forced to do things that compromise their integrity. Quit, Koppel told him, without any frills. If you start doing those things, you're never going to be able to get out from under it. Once, it actually worked that way. Back in 1965, when his bosses would not run live hearings about the war in Vietnam, CBS News president Fred Friendly, Ed Murrow's former partner, walked away, his integrity intact. Can anyone even imagine David Weston quitting over principle? Here's a little experiment. If one of Weston's corporate bosses suggested, let's do more interviews with Britney Spears, and this time, let's get her to show more skin, Which would his response more likely be? A. I'm running a news division, not a strip show. Or B. Great idea. I'll get right on it. 54. Neil Shapiro. I readily acknowledge that a lot of you won't care one bit about what Neil Shapiro, the president of NBC News, has done to his news organization. I understand that to a lot of people, it's no big deal when the suits on Executive Row blur the line between news and entertainment. But when they blur the difference between news and journalistic prostitution, then we all ought to care. Here's the problem. In the spring of 2004, while another news magazine was covering real news like the abuses at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, Dateline, which is part of NBC News, had more pressing journalistic priorities. Dateline was busy shilling for NBC Entertainment, the news magazine devoting hours of programming, entire editions of Dateline, to pure, unadulterated fluff about the season finale of The Apprentice and the final episodes of two long-running NBC hit comedies, Frasier and Friends. Dateline ran about 5 hours in all, 2 full hours of so-called Apprentice news in just 1 week. To a lot of people, this may sound harmless enough. Some may even be thinking, hey, I like The Apprentice and Frasier and Friends. I'm glad I got to see what goes on behind the scenes of those shows. But there's a reason Tom Brokaw didn't sit down with the contestants from The Apprentice. There's a reason he didn't ask the stars of Friends how it feels to be saying goodbye after so many years. The reason is that Tom Brokaw, and now his replacement Brian Williams, is a serious journalist, and this isn't something serious journalists do. Either Neil Shapiro doesn't get it, or more likely, he doesn't want to get it. It's no small point that his boss, NBC President Jeff Zucker, likes this kind of cross-promotion. And the way it works in network television news these days is when your boss says jump, you say how high, even if, now make that especially if, you're the president of the news division. Call me old-fashioned, but the way I see it, if you're going to sell your journalistic soul, at least sell out for a fancy title, lots of money, and really cool perks. Never mind. That's exactly what Neil Shapiro is selling out for. 53. Anna Nicole Smith. If you gave Anna Nicole Smith a choice, push button number 1 and you could win a Nobel Prize, or push button number 2 and you'll be on the cover of People magazine, is there any doubt that Anna would trample you, your grandma, and maybe even that silly little dog of hers to get to button number 2? Anna Nicole Smith represents something important about our culture, something that needs to be talked about. Let's call it the vulgarization of the personal, the idea that nothing is private anymore, or should be, that turning one's life into a big fat public spectacle is perfectly okay. Anna, for sure, isn't alone. There's the TV personality who just had to get engaged at the NBA All-Star Game so that she could share the moment with the whole world by making sure the proposal was on the big screen TV hanging over the arena. There's the Hollywood star who has to keep us all up to date about how her pregnancy is going. There are all the other Hollywood celebs who can't wait to go public with news that they were drug addicts or alcoholics, but now, just out of rehab this afternoon, have a new mission in life, which is to tell us all about what it was like being a drug addict or an alcoholic. But when it comes to bizarre self-exploitation, Anna sets the bar as high as anyone. She couldn't just pop up every now and then on Jay Leno's show, like all the other less-than-scintillating beautiful people, and tell us, say, about her weight issues. No, thanks to the cable television E-Network, we know about her leopard skin wallpaper, about her bed, about her bathroom, about her passing out in limousines, about her yelling at people, about her eating contest, about her toady assistants, about everything, Anna. But here's the craziest part. When I see Anna Nicole Smith, I think of Joe DiMaggio. Seriously. Because he was the opposite of so much of what we see today. Joe was the epitome of style and grace, and if some of that was only a facade, well, that just proves the point, that he cared enough to behave with dignity when he was out in public. DiMaggio's personal life was personal. He didn't tell us how he felt about anything, let alone about such painful things as his troubled relationships with family members or the death of the woman he loved. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? We need you more now than ever. We all know where Anna is, and that's the problem. 52. Marcos Moulitsis. On March 31, 2004, four American civilian contractors were on their way to work in Iraq when they were ambushed and savagely killed by a gang of insurgents who shot them and set their cars on fire. A cheering crowd then dragged the bodies into the street and dismembered them before hanging the corpses from a bridge for the world to see. In the United States, here is how another American, a Chicago-born man in his early 30s named Marcos Moulitsis, reacted to the news on his website, dailycost.com. "I feel nothing over the death of the mercenaries. They aren't in Iraq because of orders or because they are trying to help the people make Iraq a better place. They are there to wage war for profit. Screw them." We live in a big country with more than a few nasty but basically unimportant screwballs out there. And if Moulitsis simply were one of them, he would not even be worth my time or yours. But Marcos Moulitsis isn't just another anonymous run-of-the-mill loser. He's a big, important operative, a Democratic consultant who has close ties to lots of mainstream Democrats, including Howard Dean, the new head of the Democratic National Committee. And in case you're wondering, DailyCost.com is not some obscure little nothing of a site. It is immensely popular, especially with liberals, especially the angry kind. The site gets 400,000 page views a day, which, according to people who know about these things, makes it one of, if not the busiest political weblogs on the internet. When Marcos Moulitsis speaks, liberals listen. Yes, it's true that not many liberals are as crude as Moulitsis. Much as they may detest George W. Bush and his policies, few, hearing that four fellow Americans had been brutally murdered in Iraq, would ever think, let alone actually say out loud, "screw them." But here's where it gets tricky. While they may sincerely mourn for those who've died, there's little question that a lot of Moulitsis's readers actually do actively root for bad news, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or here at home with the economy. Like Moulitsis, they are pessimistic, defeatist, and way too often nasty, and in their bitterness, they're for anything that makes George W. Bush look bad. Consider the elections in Iraq in early 2005. As every dispassionate observer knows, they went remarkably well. Decent people everywhere were stirred by the sight of a people still under siege, proudly showing off their purple ink-stained fingers for everyone to see. So what's a good liberal to do at such a remarkable historical moment? Give George Bush just a little credit? Some have, of course, but not Marcos Moulitsis. Here's what he wrote on DailyCost.com. "January was the third bloodiest month for the U.S. and Allied troops. Will that cease now that Iraqis have voted? Nope. The war will continue unabated." Maybe it will, but that's not the point. Something good had just happened in Iraq, but Marcos Moulitsis and the others like him couldn't be happy even for 2 seconds. Once upon a time, liberals were the optimistic ones. They were the hopeful ones. They were the upbeat ones. Now, too often, too many of them see darkness wherever they look. Nothing can go right, as far as they're concerned, as long as George Bush is around. So what do liberals who loathe W have to look forward to now that their guy lost the presidential election in 2004 and for the first time in a long time, some hope is trickling out of the Middle East? Well, with a little luck, maybe Iraq will descend into a bloody civil war, or Iran may blow up in Bush's face, or maybe North Korea will launch a nuke on Honolulu, or maybe the stock market will crash, or there'll be an outbreak of the plague in Kansas. Hold on, Kansas. Kansas is a red state, right? So as Mr. Moulitsis might, no, make that would put it, Screw them. 51. Ann Palo. Remember when you first found out about the Blue Angels, the elite Navy flight demonstration squad that has thrilled generations of American kids since its formation at the end of World War II? Maybe you ran across a picture of them in a book or in Life magazine. Maybe it was seeing them perform their amazing feats of high-speed air acrobatics on TV or in a classroom film. Maybe, if you were lucky, it was when they came to your hometown for one of their famous shows. However it happened, for most of us, as small kids, watching the Blue Angels was thrilling. These were genuine heroes, men with unbelievable skill, daring, and courage. And even more than that, these were men, and now also women, ready to give their lives to protect our freedoms, if that's what it took. But that's not how Ann Palo sees it. She's the co-author of a manual for preschool teachers called That's Not Fair, A Teacher's Guide to Activism with Young Children. In it, Palo tells us that she has a commitment to peace and justice, that she wants to help shape children's values and to coach them about how to oppose injustice, and that when she was a kid herself, her family decried the injustices of the dominant culture, but we were still a part of it. Get the picture? Think of That's Not Fair as Michael Moore for toddlers. How do the Blue Angels fit in? Well, Palo includes a section in her manual where she describes how she handled a situation one day when her tiny chargers were out in a park in Seattle and happened to see the Fame Flyers practicing their stunts overhead. "Those are Navy airplanes," Palo told the little kids. "They're built for war, but right now there is no war, so the pilots learn how to do fancy tricks in their planes." That was good with the kids, but not good enough for Ann Palo. The next day, when the planes flew over the park again, she asked them to communicate their feelings about the Blue Angels. "They drew pictures of the planes with X's through them," she reports with satisfaction. "They drew bomb factories labeled No. And respect our words, Blue Angels. Respect kids' words. Don't kill people." They said, "If you blow up our city, we won't be happy about it, and our whole city will be destroyed. And if you blow up my favorite library, I won't be happy because there are some good books there that I haven't read yet." Are you kidding me? Are we supposed to believe that little kids who can't wipe their own runny noses came up with this on their own? But what's really frightening is that this kind of thing is not an aberration. Far from it. As older kids are increasingly fed PC history that relentlessly stresses America's role as an oppressor, and junior high and high school English classes today are often more concerned with a writer's ethnic background than the quality of his work, more and more of the youngest school children are being taught by those with an activist leftist agenda. Once again, it takes an ordinary person with common sense, in this case a reader of That's Not Fair, who felt the need to respond to it on Amazon, to say it best. "The authors of this book should never be allowed in front of a group of small children ever again, and neither should any other teacher who would seriously consider using this drivel as a legitimate resource for their classroom. It is frightening and dangerous," the review continued, "to even think that teachers would be willing to indoctrinate the smallest children in such a manner by telling them that the Blue Angels would try to bomb their town. It is ghastly." 50. John Vasconcelos. California State Senator John Vasconcelos is not a bad person. To the contrary, he appears to be a very good person who wishes only the very best things for children and other living things. Unfortunately, John Vasconcelos' idea of what is good for others have had very, very bad consequences in the real world. Recently term-limited out of office after more than 30 years representing the Silicon Valley in the California legislature, Vasconcelos likes to describe himself as a pragmatic idealist, and his website adds he will probably be best remembered as the Johnny Appleseed of self-esteem. I wouldn't brag about that. But maybe that's just me. As for Vasconcelos, he remains one of America's biggest cheerleaders for the self-esteem movement. that he has done so much to promote and impose on the nation's schools, and he'll tell anyone who will listen that his worldview is born of personal experience, that as a child, I had been conditioned to know myself basically as a sinner, guilt-ridden and ashamed, constantly beating my breast and professing my unworthiness. But in the glorious 1960s, he attained self-knowledge and understood the power of self-esteem. Far from being some zonked-out idealist, as a powerful California politician, Vasconcelos was in a position to do something about his obsession. In 1986, he founded the California Task Force to Promote Self-Esteem and Personal Social Responsibility, which, 3 years later, issued a report declaring self-esteem a vaccine that would attack academic failure, drug use, and juvenile crime, and which led to legislation promoting self-esteem-driven curricula in the state schools. And, as goes California, with its reputation for being on the cutting edge of all things new and exciting, so goes the nation. And the fixation on self-esteem was soon a national phenomenon. By the mid-90s, self-esteem programs were in place in elementary schools in thousands of districts across the nation. The Los Angeles Times described the kids in one L.A. school with especially low test scores spending time in daily I Love Me lessons, in which they completed the phrase, I am, blank, with words such as beautiful, lovable, respectable, kind, or gifted. Then they memorized the sentences to make them sink in. The consequences of all this were exactly what anyone with an ounce of common sense would have expected. No fewer than 10,000 research studies have now shown that in academic terms, self-esteem curricula are worse than useless. By the end of the 90s, test scores, rather than rising, were falling, and the movement had no effect on drug use or crime. Indeed, a University of Michigan study showed that while American students lagged far behind their Asian counterparts in math, they outranked them in only one area: self-confidence. But even after all this time, John Vasconcelos still doesn't buy it. All the research in the world, he flatly declares, won't change my mind about it. Maybe that's what prompted one of his last major acts in the state Senate, his introduction in 2004 of a proposed constitutional amendment to lower the voting age, in which 16-year-olds would get a half vote and 14-year-olds a quarter vote in state elections. Hey, dude, why not? Sure, it would screw up California even more. But hey, think of what it could do for the kid's self-esteem. Ingrid Newkirk. If you don't follow these things too closely, I guess it's easy to write off Ingrid Newkirk, co-founder, president, and loudmouth-in-chief of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, as just another screwball. After all, isn't PETA the outfit that gets those supermodels to pose nude in anti-fur ads? Hasn't Newkirk herself written in her last will and testament that when she dies, in order to drive home her pro-animal message, that she wants the meat of my body or a portion thereof to be used for a human barbecue? And isn't she the one who, when she's 6 feet under, wants her pals to dispatch her no longer living liver to France as a protest? Against what? What else? Foie gras, also known as liver pâté. Hey, I like animals as much as the next guy, but I'm not sending anything to France when I die, certainly not my liver. But all of this is small, not even vaguely controversial stuff for Ingrid Newkirk. And why should it be, when you consider some of the other things she believes in and has talked about over the years? For example, 6 million Jews died in concentration camps, but 6 billion broiler chickens will die this year in slaughterhouses. Ingrid Newkirk said that in the Washington Post, November 13, 1983. There is no rational basis for saying that a human being has special rights. A rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. They're all mammals. Ingrid Newkirk said that in Vogue magazine, September 1989. Okay, maybe the liver to France stuff is funny, but I stopped laughing a long time ago. Maybe this woman who equates the slaughter of chickens to the Holocaust and who would ban animal testing that stands to save hundreds of thousands of human lives and sees a human child as not better than a rat is an irresponsible zealot and a moral monstrosity, no matter how well-meaning her intentions may be. But what's even worse than Newkirk's ridiculously misplaced sense of priorities is that she and her organization are not a joke. To the contrary, in recent years, fueled by clever marketing built around an appeal to people's natural love of animals, PETA has grown into a powerful force, more powerful than you probably think. Its membership now numbers more than 750,000, and because it uses as recruiting tools the shallowest, least informed, most emotionally driven among us, that is, celebrities, PETA's support continues to grow. PETA's targets are generally corporations that rely on animal products, or even more ominously, scientific research labs that use animals in experimentation. And with the help of a largely uncritical press, it's had a great deal of success in imposing its radical agenda. It's one thing, for instance, when PETA gets Calvin Klein to stop using fur in its clothes, but quite another when it pressures corporate contributors to stop giving to the March of Dimes because a small percentage of its resources go to organizations that do animal experimentation. That kind of thinking can cost human beings their lives. But Newkirk apologizes for none of it, bragging that our opponents know we never let up. And when legal means fail to get the job done, Newkirk is perfectly ready to endorse far more drastic tactics. While PETA may be best known for such unsavory but relatively innocuous actions as dousing fur-clad women with red paint or blood or depositing a dead raccoon on the plate of Newkirk's foe, Vogue editor Anna Wintour, the group makes no secret that it applauds those who go much, much further. I find it small wonder that the laboratories where they do scientific experiments on animals aren't all burning to the ground, says Newkirk. If I had more guts, I'd light a match. The amazing thing about Newkirk and PETA is that if you give it even a moment's thought, you'll see that their entire argument makes no sense. After all, violence is part of nature. Animals kill. They eat other animals all the time. It's called survival of the fittest. What's more natural than that? But when a reporter actually tried to question Newkirk about the obvious contradictions in her philosophy, she immediately shut him up, demanding, "Stop asking these nutty questions." And Ingrid Newkirk knows something about nutty. 48. Robert Byrd. You'd think that Senator Robert Byrd would maybe be just a little bit embarrassed. I mean, here he stands on the Senate floor, week after week and month after month, going on self-righteously about decency and morality, liberally quoting Scripture and Shakespeare and the sages of ancient Rome. "Error wounded writhes in pain and dies among his worshippers," he thunders as once again he attacks American policy in Iraq. And, "Today I weep for my country."